There is this thing. Do you realize there is this thing? Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Hi, welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM in Montreal. My name is Sean Lathrop.
And my name is Amy Lloyd. Today we broadcast live from the Kiotiage, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nation. The time now is 5:01.
This week's episode focuses on media accountability. We have another audio essay on the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Islamophobia. We also have in-depth news coverage from the Daily News editor, Athena Khalid. And finally, we have an interview with Jesse Brown, host of the Canada Land podcast and former McGill student.
And of course, we'll give you an update on local news. Enjoy the rest of our jingle and a little tune.
We'll be right back. That was Moscow Apartment with Orange. The time now is 5:05. Now for our weekly headline roundup.
Last Wednesday, Juan Guaido announced himself as the interim president of Venezuela after Nicolas Maduro refused to step down. 10 countries, including Canada, publicly recognized Guaido as the new leader of Venezuela. Since 2014, Venezuela's economy has been in despair due to dropping oil prices. As a result, the country has seen a shortage of food along with necessary imports. Guaido has promised to lead a fair and free presidential election, hopefully limiting violence between citizens and authoritative security forces.
After 40 years of failed negotiations with Ottawa, Chief Christian Awashish of the Atikamekw community of Obedjuan has decided to sue the city. Chief Awashish is fighting for title over lands located in the Outre-Maurice region. The land includes wetlands, rivers, and boreal forests, and consists of 26,000 square kilometers. The Atikamekw did not sign a treaty to give away their territory to the Government of Canada. On Tuesday, Chief Awashish officially filed their suit against the federal government and Montreal's Superior Court.
This upcoming Friday will be the official start to the Muslim Awareness Week in Quebec. Lina Besadan, spokesperson of the initiative, states that the Awareness Week will include numerous activities to inform and educate Quebecers on the Muslim community. Besadan was inspired after a shooting in 2017 that occurred in her parents' mosque in Quebec City. 6 people were killed. Events will take place in churches, synagogues, mosques, cultural centers, and universities. This week is organized around the anniversary of the shooting. Besadan wants to ensure that this tragic shooting will never be forgotten. This week aimed at stereotypes surrounding the Muslim community.
After a 35-day shutdown over funding the border wall, the U.S. government will be reopened until the 15th of February 2019. The shutdown resulted in the U.S. government losing over $30 billion U.S. dollars. As such, 800,000 federal government employees went over a month without being paid. During the 5-week shutdown, it was reported that the American economy lost $11 billion U.S. dollars. Workers are expected to be paid for the 5 weeks of missed paychecks.
A group of single mothers finally evacuated their homes after going weeks without heat or hot water. Currently, they are staying at a hotel on Declare Boulevard. They are unsure of where they will go next. Melissa Robertson, a mother of three, reports her NDG building, which is managed by the nonprofit group Project Chance, went 3 weeks without no heating during this cold winter. Project Chance offers subsidized housing to single moms who are finishing their education. After a visit from city inspectors, the building was reported to have a burst pipe, mold, and rats. Repairs would cost around $260,000. Unfortunately, Project Chance is unable to pay this. Natalie Robertson, a McGill student, issued a statement to CTV saying, "I'm in this program because I'm trying to finish my studies at McGill and move on with my life. And if they were to shut this program down, I'm just not sure. It may take months before they are able to fix the building."
That was our weekly headline roundup. Please stay tuned for a special report after this song.
Les gros week-ends, c'est chez Couche-Tard que ça se passe.
Hey mon Paul, as-tu fait le plein pour le gros week-end du Super Bowl?
Si j'ai fait le plein, hey, j'ai tellement acheté de liquide que c'est moi qui commandite l'arrosage du coach en fin de match.
Hey bonne!
C'est encore un gros week-end chez Couche-Tard. Du 31 janvier au 3 février, la caisse de 24 Heineken ou Corona est à 27,99 et la caisse de 12 Pepsi est à 3,99. Couche-Tard. Simple comme bonjour. 18 ans et plus, détails en magasin.
Late nights, are you sleepless too? Wide awake in the starless blue, staring up at the ceiling. Do you feel what I'm feeling? Little fights at the weekend do. You love me better when I'm not with you. We were built like concrete. I used to know your heartbeat. The light has disappeared. The dust has settled here. But still I want you near. So I've been waiting for that soul fade.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. The time is 5:10. That was Slow Fade by Ruth B. You're listening to CKUT on 90.3 FM in Montreal. Now we have an audio essay by us, produced by us.
And welcome back to Quebec City, where we're trying to understand what happened here last night.
Quebec City is now being transcended.
marks the second anniversary of the mosque shooting that occurred in Quebec City in the suburb of Sainte-Foy. Alexandre Bissonnette is responsible for 6 counts of first-degree murder and 5 counts of attempted murder. He's also responsible for injuring 19 people when he entered the largest mosque in Quebec City, located at the Centre Culturel Islamique de Québec, and opened fire. He will receive his sentence on the 8th of February 2019. Bissonnette is facing life in prison. He was known in certain circles as a right-winged activist who was in favor of Trump's xenophobic political viewpoint and against progressive immigration policies. Bissonnette issued the attack 2 days after Trump ordered a 90-day ban on visits from seven Muslim countries. Furthermore, around the same time, Quebec was having its own debate surrounding religious accommodations. The following Thursday and Friday, funeral services were held for the victims, Adel Khim Hassin, Yahid Belkacemi, Abu Beka Septi, Mamadou Tanu Berry, Brahima Berry, and Azadini Soufini. In response, Canadians donated hundreds of thousands to organizations in order to support families impacted by the shooting. Donations were just to provide short-term and long-term financial support, from children's education to personal debt. Dawanet Canada, a nonprofit community organization in Mississauga, raised over $250,000. The Islamic Relief Canada has raised over $135,000. Trudeau issued a statement in the House of Commons stating,
Make no mistake, this was a terrorist attack. It was an attack on our most intrinsic and cherished values as Canadians, values of openness, diversity, and freedom of religion. The people who commit these acts mean to test our resolve and weaken our values. They aim to divide us, to sow discord, and plant hatred. We will not.
Vigils throughout Quebec City, Montreal, as well as in other Canadian cities, were held. A year later, in remembrance of the first anniversary of the shooting, a vigil with over 1,000 gatherers was held in Quebec City, where the names of the victims were read out loud, followed by the names of their children. Prime Minister Trudeau and Quebec Premier Philippe Couillard held hands while walking into the mosque with a sign saying, Je me souviens, translating to in English, I remember.
Why does the word Islamophobia make us uneasy? Well, it's because it goes to fears. It goes to the irrational.
Last year, 30 McGill students held a vigil to commemorate this shooting. Students stood on the stairs of the Arts Building on the 29th of January 2018. The event was organized by the McGill Anti-Racist Committee. In May of 2018, McGill began offering 2 bursaries for $1,200 each in order to promote tolerance and understanding. The award is in honor of the mosque shooting, titled the Centre Culturel Islamique de Québec Memorial Award. Students who foster inclusion of Muslim folks within both Quebecois and Canadian society will be awarded the bursary. So far, they have raised $17,537.47 for the bursary fund. To donate, go to Seeds of Change and search Centre Culturel Islamique de Québec Memorial Award. This year, McGill's Associate Provost at Equity and Academic Policies, the Institute of Islamic Studies, and the Muslim Students Association partnered together in order to host a commemoration in honor of the victims of the shooting. The event was held in association with Muslim Awareness Week.
I know you don't like poems, especially mine, and especially since mine never get told when you need them. And I know that I live some inner life and thinks it's living outside but isn't, and only wakes up when something knocks too hard, and when something is gone, as if gazing up the road, I miss the bus. and wave the poem at its shadow. But bus and shadow exist all the same, and I'll send you more poems, even if they arrive late. What stops us from meeting at this place and imagining ourselves big as the world and broad enough to take it in and grow ancient is fear and our carelessness and standing in the throne of the wicked place we live in and not seeing a way out all the time and never clearly all at once, a way out all the time and not at the same time and abandoning each other to chance and small decisions. But if I ever thought that I could never recover the thought, struggling to live through my imperfect mouth and life and way, if I thought that I could do nothing about the world, then well, and we've hung on to old hurts, as if that was all there was, and as if no amount of sadness would be enough for our old, insistent, not becoming selves. And if sadness should not end, so for this I send you more poems, even if they only wave, and even if I only look up late to see your shadow rushing by.
The event was open to anyone, including both the McGill community and members of the general public. It took place in the mezzanine of the McDonald Engineering Building at 12 p.m. today. In 2017, the National Council of Canadian Muslims asked Prime Minister Trudeau to recognize the 29th of January as the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Islamophobia. Quebec political groups, such as Parti Québécois, are opposed to this proposal, claiming the language is too controversial. Trudeau was hesitant to declare today as the official a national day of remembrance and action on Islamophobia, despite claiming that he stands with the Muslim community and plans to fight against Islamophobia. With today marking the second anniversary, Quebec politicians and Trudeau have yet to reach a conclusive decision. Coalition Avenir Quebec believe Islamophobia is a problematic and inappropriate term since, supposedly, Quebecers are not Islamophobic. The coalition is ignoring the facts of the shooting. The shooter targeted a mosque, and all his victims identified as Muslim. The attack was targeted and fueled by xenophobic politics. The only party to publicly recognize today as the National Day of Remembrance and Action on Islamophobia is the left-wing group Quebec Solidaire Party. It is apparent that Quebec's government has yet to communicate with its citizen and reach an accurate, in-depth, and diverse sense of identity as a province. To say Quebecers are not Islamophobic is not only ignorant, but immediately prevents respectful and productive discourse surrounding the current intense socio-political climate. Although Trudeau is a pro at issuing sentimental statements after tragedy, he often fails to devise any concrete plans to better the country. And it is our job as citizens to hold our politicians accountable. Today we honor the victims and their families. We also remember the Islamophobic agenda which led to the attack in the first place. We must take time to educate ourselves on Islamophobia and the ways in which one can implicitly and explicitly perpetuate systemic marginalization towards Muslim communities.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. The poetry reading you heard in that audio essay was from today's vigil, which took place in the McConnell Engineering Building. Now we have a song and a short ad.
Can the woman play the mouth? I played so long, so long. From the hopes I let them roll,
Join director Christy Garland on opening night, January 25th at Cinéma du Parc for the national theatrical run of the critically acclaimed film What Wala Wants. Journey with Wala, a young woman from the West Bank, as she pursues her unusual dream of becoming a police officer in these turbulent times. With unprecedented access, the film shows us the realities of one of today's determined young women. Montreal is the first stop as the film travels across Canadian theaters this winter. For more information, check local film listings or listen to CKUT programming to win tickets. What Wala Wants, opening January 25th. This is a CKUT Pro presentation.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. The time now is 5:21. That was Cold Specs with Wildcard and then an ad. Now we are going to play an interview I did earlier this week with Canada Land's Jesse Brown. Canada Land is a news site and a podcast network funded by its audience. Its primary focus is on media criticism and media reporting, although it also produces a true crime podcast as well as cultural commentary. I asked Jesse about Canada Land and media accountability, his experiences with alternative media, and the opportunities and disadvantages of student journalism. Hi, Jesse. It's Sean from the McGill Daily.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay.
So let's dive right in. Can you tell me a little bit about why and how you started Candleland?
Sure. I started Candleland because Canada had no media criticism. There was a lot of stuff that I was enjoying and following coming out of the U.S. at the time, everything from journalistic approaches to media reporting and criticism, like On the Media, or the late David Carr was still writing his column in the New York Times, and there were dozens of other media critics writing for various American newspapers. He also had satirical takes, like The Daily Show, as we still do, and then there was stuff like Gawker that was doing a more snarky, gossip-based, but a lot of investigative work as well, looking at the media from a very critical point of view. And as somebody who'd been working in various magazines, radio, sometimes newspapers for about 15 years, and being kind of an observer of the Canadian media scene and aware of a lot of its problems, and, it was alarming. You know, it was interesting to me that nobody was doing that kind of stuff here, and I knew that I was interested in reading that kind of stuff. So I pitched around various forms of media criticism, media reporting, columns to newspapers that I had worked with or editors that I knew, shows. I pitched a show to the CBC, podcast version. I pitched to TVO, people I'd worked with before. McLean's, who I was writing for, considered it for a while. Anyhow, there was always interest, and then it would always sort of fizzle. And as the idea was sort of, run past executives and higher ups, they would shoot it down. And I would get a series of excuses or, reasons for that, I suppose, ranging from no one's interested. Maybe they're interested in how American media gets made, but nobody cares about how Canadian media gets made, or various versions of that, basically. After some frustration, I just decided to do it on my own, and I launched Canada Land as a weekly podcast that I was just sort of doing, for free. I had a sponsor, so I was able to get FreshBooks to sponsor the original run, but pretty soon I was losing money on it, and but it immediately connected with an audience, and very quickly I was getting thousands of downloads per episode, and then people started bringing me stories. I didn't really think that, given the resources I had, I was just trying to do a conversation with the journalist every week. But because there was nowhere else to bring media stories, people started bringing me stories, and Candleland quickly became a place that broke news, that investigated and broke news stories.
Yeah, you mentioned Gawker's investigative journalism, and I've been listening to Candleland for a while now, and it strikes me that you guys dedicate a lot of your resources to investigative projects. What do you think is so important about investigative journalism?
Well, all journalism to some extent is investigative. We kind of specifically talk about, enterprise investigations, and now everyone, be it whether people are thinking of All the President's Men or they're thinking of Spotlight or, you know, there's sort of like a category where you kind of have a team of very specialized journalists or journalists working for a long time, and, you know, that's incredibly important work. But I kind of think that, like, you are investigating no matter what. You should be. Otherwise, you're just sort of repeating or chewing on stuff that other people learned, because the ecosystem of news, someone has to find out the information, and then we can kind of process it or build upon it or analyze it or write a column about it. Somebody's got to actually find out the facts. And the more involved the story, I mean, we have, like, you know, stories that go up every week where somebody actually just had to find stuff out and report it out, and they don't necessarily identify as an investigative journalist. But anyhow, I'm getting a bit semantic here. I think that these, like, the crisis that we're in with in journalism right now, and everything that's happened with from at first it was the aggregators, websites coming in, just sort of taking news stories and reformatting them without doing any of the actual work. Or, you know, and then it's even degraded to the point where at least that you know, is, or you're, you know, using somebody else's work, but at least it's true. Now we're seeing stories that aren't even true, or just, you know, plucking something from the internet and putting a new spin on it. So, you know, as everyone is waking up to just how dangerous that is and how shallow it is, for everybody to be kind of chewing on the same bone, I think it's put a new emphasis on, you know, that original enterprise reporting. And so, you know, the stuff that was most exciting to me that Gawker put out was when they actually would go, you know, of course, they broke the Rob Ford crack video story, you know, and, you know, in my own experience, I never initially considered myself an investigative reporter, but first people brought tips to us about, to me, when it was just me, and then us, about CBC journalists who were taking massive checks from the oil and gas industry to do speaking for the petroleum industry, even as they were covering the petroleum industry and not disclosing any of this. And so just verifying that, investigating it, and then reporting it was thrilling. It was a very exciting work, and it felt like, wow, like if we hadn't looked at this and published it, people wouldn't know this.
Yeah.
And so that led to the Gomeshi story, and, you know, it just seemed like there was nothing more important that we could be doing than that. So, you know, as the company has evolved, we've put more resources into that. And now we have a news team that, you know, Jaron Kerr spent months investigating the Kielbergers We organization. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, commission original stories, and we have ongoing investigations that take months. It's a very expensive thing to do. But, you know, we have this relationship with our patrons where it seems like, yes, they want, you know, interesting and evocative podcasts on the regular, but they understand that, like, and they'll put money towards specific projects, be it investigating Thunder Bay to tell a much more involved story, or investigating sexual misconduct allegations, whatever it might be. You know, we have a really good model where people are willing to back these things, even though it takes a long time to get a little bit of content.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about the Thunder Bay podcast and what sort of work goes into it behind the scenes. Like, I'm not really sure how you go about creating such an in-depth analysis of a place.
It's, you know, both a very involved process and also, like, it's what you might imagine. I think that, you know, we began with doing kind of a preliminary kind of research project where a reporter named Bridget Noel kind of started by looking at what had been done and collecting all of the major threads and major stories that people had been looking at, and tried to get a timeline of when these major news events, when these teenagers died, when the investigations took place, who were the players, who's involved. And then you kind of move from reading other people's work to picking up the phone and, you know, okay, here's a person whose name appears in a bunch of news stories. Let's see if I can get them on the phone. And so she began just conducting interviews and building up a dossier and trying to get more understanding and figuring out who is willing to talk with us. And then we started to go there. First, Ryan did a number of trips. And, you know, I think it was really a priority of his to build relationships and build trust. Mm-hmm. He doesn't come from a classical journalism background. He has a deep cultural and personal understanding of indigenous communities, and has a a deep connection to Thunder Bay itself. And what was invaluable there was just that he put in the time to earn that trust and build those relationships. And then I would come, and David Crosby, another producer here, we would come to Thunder Bay, and we, with Ryan, would start to just interview people and just talk to anyone, talk to people on the streets, people who Bridget had pre-interviewed, we would go and meet them. Some people who were no longer in Thunder Bay, we would find them wherever they were. And, you know, I was driving to, you know, homes in rural Ontario, and we just, you know, basically just started building and building before we really even knew necessarily which stories we're going to tell or how we're going to tell them. You know, dozens and dozens of interviews and hundreds of hours of tape, and then you kind of at a certain point say, okay, let's try to organize these into categories and organize these into narratives and figure out what is missing from each of these stories. So that was the process. It took about a year.
And you mentioned something that I've been curious about for a while, which is sort of like the editorial process with podcasts. Can you speak to a little bit to that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure to expand on what I've, you know, the editorial process, beyond those, those early stages where you're just sort of, getting everything that you can. And, sometimes, you know, people would reach out to us. We used the fact that we had a platform and, you know, we had people backing Thunder Bay and paying for it before we even started. And then, you know, the word was out that we were doing this. So people made themselves available to us too. There were people who live in Thunder Bay who've been collecting, you know, news clippings and quotes and things that they felt were like, I can't believe this is happening and no one's paid any attention to it, or why was this not followed up on? And so some people had, you know, it's incredible how much journalism non-journalists can do. People had been doing their own archiving. People had been getting court documents. So some of those people were just getting in touch with us and emailing it to us. And then we would follow up on that and go and get the, whatever court documents were still missing. People were sending us YouTube videos from the past of Thunder Bay. We also were very lucky to have the cooperation of a number of journalists who live in Thunder Bay and who've been reporting from there for, you know, APTN or CBC. You know, it was a really collaborative process and an open process that I think is really where I think journalism is going and should be going, which is that, you know, we're so beleaguered and there's so much pressure on each individual news organization that the old competitive atmosphere, I think, has to go. And there was just a willingness, people that just wanted the story told. So they were, you know, really, really helpful in giving us the context and connecting us. So you do whatever you can, and you kind of just collect all of these strands and put it all together.
You mentioned a while ago about the restructuring of media sites and newspapers over the last 10, even 15 years. Now that we've seen Facebook sort of, I want to say fall from grace. So we've seen like views don't actually correlate with engagement in the same way. Advertising isn't looking as profitable. Do you think traditional newsrooms could make sort of a comeback?
I missed some of that. I heard the question, do I think traditional newsrooms can make a comeback? But I missed what you were saying before that.
I was just mentioning that the restructuring of newspapers and media sites in the past 10 and 15 years or so, and now that we've seen Facebook sort of fall from grace in a certain way, and we've seen that advertising isn't as profitable as we once thought it was, in light of that, do you think that traditional newsrooms could make a comeback?
Right. I think that values from traditional newsrooms can make a comeback and are making a comeback. I think that the traditional newsroom, sadly, itself is gone. I mean, the resources to have, when I actually talk to older journalists about just what they had at their fingertips, nobody can do that anymore. Mm-hmm. the number of editors that some stories would go through at some papers, and you know, but both up and down, you'd have tons of resources in terms of junior reporters and interns and people who could like take care of some of the more procedural fact checking and stuff, and then you had people above you where you could have like, I don't know, circuit edits where different editors are looking at something, and it just goes through a process where everything is looked at so closely, and the resources are just like, I don't know who has that anymore. Mm-hmm. What I think we're learning, you know, and what I think maybe your question is pointing towards is that, you know, that's a long time ago as well, because even before the internet decimated everything, with circulation going down, newspapers were chipping away at those resources year after year and really racing with each other to see how little they could put into their news product. And the product, you know, it's a terrible strategy where people were showing less and less interest in the product, and the industry's response was to make the product of lower and lower quality. So what we're learning now is that, like, the only journalism that can have a chance of withstanding what's happening is the highest quality. And journalism that relies on a widespread audience as the economic model, because it's based on advertising dollars, is in the shakiest position, because those ad dollars, you know, I think 85% of them go to Facebook or Google, and the rates are going lower and lower, and so it's a race to the bottom where you know, to make up for that, you need more and more people to read, and news was never really a mass product. It was always a smaller percentage of the population that was interested in hard news. And so what's emerging is that the model for doing the highest quality of journalism it seems to be best suited to direct relationships where the reader is paying for the journalism. The reader is not paying with their attention, with, you know, 3 seconds of attention because they clicked on something. They're paying a much, you know, whatever fraction of a penny that was worth. They're actually willing to pay many multiples of that. A much smaller group of people are willing to pay a lot more, or worth a lot more, I guess, you know, in that instead of making a fraction of a penny, they're worth a few pennies per article or something like that, because they are your direct subscriber. All of which is to say that is a return to sort of some first principles. And we can kind of get a more honest and transparent relationship with what we're doing and why. We are not being paid to amuse necessarily. We're not being paid to kind of titillate people with celebrity stuff. You know, like,
yeah,
that serious stuff is happening for audiences that want to pay for serious stuff.
This is sort of like a broad question, so feel free to answer this any way you want. What does media reform look like to you, especially in, you know, larger news corporations? Like, what does responsibility look like?
What does profitability look like?
A responsibility.
Responsibility.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, everyone's just fighting for survival, right? So the question of reform is one, I think, that is most urgent for legacy news organizations, where the question is really, the answer to the question is really unknown as to whether or not reform financially, like, can they reform their model in a way that they will sustain themselves? And the best solution we seem to be able to come up with in Canada is for the federal government to bail them out, because they've basically thrown in the towel and said, we can't figure this out. Like, we cannot sustain ourselves. You know, I'm very critical of that conclusion. I think they have not really legitimately tried. But even in atmospheres where, in other models where there's no chance of a government bailout like the U.S., you can kind of look at some best-case scenarios where, well, what is a newspaper that has really reformed itself? You can look at the Washington Post or the New York Times, and even there, we're not conclusive. I mean, they've shown some real, real wonderful results, and you know, the you know, political atmosphere is certainly a part of that. But you know, the Trump bump in subscriptions that the New York Times and the, you know, Washington Post have seen, But they're kind of doing what I'm suggesting. They've returned to first principles, they've returned to investigative reporting, and they've increasingly turned to like subscriber-based business model. So that's how they've reformed. And, you know, we'll see when the dust settles if that is a sustainable, viable model. And, you know, just because it's sustainable for the New York Times doesn't mean that everybody else can do it, because not everybody's in the New York Times. Everything is being tried. You know, it's like one thing that is being tried is some people are saying, let's forget this idea that hard news should be profitable or must be profitable. Can we pursue this as a nonprofit? Can philanthropists or, you know, wealthy backers or crowdsourced philanthropy sustain news that doesn't need to make money? And, you know, ProPublica and others have proven that that model can be really, really effective. So, you know, the reforms are kind of like, you know, and then other organizations like that were once the great hope, be it, you know, BuzzFeed or Vox or Vice, you know, that there is, you know, digital first, digital native companies that don't have all these legacy costs, they will be able to create a new model. Well, they're just announcing, like, you know, layoffs after layoffs, cutbacks after cutbacks, and it's, you know, a lot of them were kind of speculative, Silicon Valley-esque, you know, overly pumped up models that at some point need to rationalize with revenue and profits, and they're disappointing their backers. So, you know, does that work, or was that just sort of, you know, a hyped up hope that is proving to be faulty? All of this stuff is kind of playing out at the same time, and it's very complicated. You know, we have a tiny little micro organization here that really, after that first year of losses, has always been in the black. Canada Land has always been profitable. It makes very little money. It's tiny, you know, but it grows every year. So I'm in this very strange, rarefied position, and it's the first time in my career I've been at a company that's getting bigger and not smaller.
I want to segue into another topic here and get your opinion on some current media accountability issues. Recently, in the Shortcut story, Naughty Daughter, you mentioned that Trudeau has a double standard when it comes to Canada's role in supporting women's rights, and he's sort of performative in his social justice. To what extent do you think that our Canadian government relies on the media to create this this like good Canadian narrative?
To what extent do I think the government
relies on the media, uses the media to create? Yeah.
To a great extent, and very effectively, though increasingly less so. I think that you know, the interesting thing about the, you know, Justin Trudeau's rise and his incredible popularity when he won is that he was able to take all of the gloss and the appearance and the suggestion of progressive politics and sensitive leadership and compassion in every different way, like from his association with himself with feminism, mm-hmm. with the gender balance cabinet, with his association with himself and Indigenous rights and Indigenous, reconciliation, everything from his tattoo, to the, you know, the photo ops that he has, mm-hmm. The language of reconciliation, the language of speaking about, finally putting an end to the water bans, and kind of like just exhaustively, he's marketed himself and been absolutely embraced by the media. Absolutely, I don't want to be exhaustive. There certainly was a lot of media pushback here in Canada, but mm-hmm. he kind of also seized the moment and leapfrogged the Canadian media, and was an international progressive, sensitive leader. You know, and his timing was just impeccable. That the contrast of Trudeau against Trump, you know, as we moved into Trump's campaign, it was irresistible to the world's media. Contrasting that with his actual policies and governance is kind of shocking. You know, this is not a particularly progressive government. You know, this is a government that was, you know, they backtracked now, but they were selling arms to Saudi Arabia. I could go on and on about that. The difference between the reality and the image of the Trudeau government is like, I think we'll be studying in textbooks of just, you know, how, you know, it's not that new. I mean, you know, the image of Obama, the Hopi changey image versus, you know, a fairly status quo administration, and, you know, one that was involved in all sorts of, you know, military adventures around the, you know, that's an old story, mm-hmm. but it was, you know, Canada's contribution to that old story was a pretty striking example.
Yeah, I want to bring up one of Trudeau's comments, actually. Last night, The Daily had a workshop with a Palestinian student group, and they brought up Trudeau's recent comments about BDS being an anti-Semitic movement. And then I looked into all of the Canadian media coverage of that comment, and I found that the media frames BDS pretty much in the same light that Trudeau has, as just because it's critical of Israel, it's therefore contributing to, like, the very real rise of anti-Semitism in this country, and in North America in general. And I just wanted to know if you thought that it was responsible to conflate those two things, especially in the media and on such a wide scale.
Sorry, is it responsible for...
To conflate, you know, the BDS movement, which is like a grassroots Palestinian organization, I'm sure you know, with, like, the rise of, like, fascism and anti-Semitism in this country.
Well, I feel like I am aware of the argument that BDS is an anti-Semitic movement, and I am aware that that argument relies on a very specific aspect of the BDS movement, which is that I believe that one of the stated goals is the right to return mm-hmm. for the Palestinian diaspora, and in the eyes of the... of the anti-BDS resistance to that, that itself is considered a threat to the existence of Israel.
Yeah.
And so they reach a conclusion that any movement that advocates for the right to return is therefore a movement against the existence of Israel and is therefore anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
I'll make no comment as to whether or not I agree with that. I'm no expert on this stuff. But what I will say is, as a media reporter, a media critic, that position is very poorly explained and reflected mm-hmm. in coverage of this. And I think that the public is increasingly asked to just accept this position that BDS equals anti-Semitism because we say so. That has the authority of the government saying, you know, we think this as well. And then you kind of arrive at this place where this one specific political campaign is, like, facing, you know, laws against it and bans that I think regular Canadians who might not have all that information would say, well, you know, wherever, like, I have the right to boycott, like, you know, that's just a yeah. protest that I can do against any country. Why is this one particular country illegal? Is it illegal to boycott them? And I think that that actually fuels anti-Semitism because yeah. it supports the idea that Jews are somehow running things and are able to kind of convince governments to get special status and that they want special rules for themselves. So yeah. I think that it's the whole thing is kind of a mess.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, the media does play a role in that because, you know, the actual technical underpinnings of that argument, whether it's valid or not, are, I think, like, nobody even, I don't know, nobody, like, very few people involved in this debate
engage
even
with
know
it.
That.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, it's not really reflected in a lot of the coverage.
Yeah. I agree. And sort of finally, just to close this interview out, this is sort of like a personal question that I've had over coming from sort of like a social justice background and an organizing background. I wanted to know what you thought about maintaining, like, journalistic integrity when engaging in narratives that, you know, you're passionate about, you care about.
I think that I'm increasingly of the opinion that journalistic integrity is not a very different term or subject from human integrity or you know, journalistic ethics and human ethics. You know, look, we have a discipline and within journalism, and we have some agreed upon standards, and we have a process that is particular to the, I don't know, is it a profession, the trade, the practice of journalism?
Yeah.
And I think it's a pretty good methodology, and I actually have more respect for the methodology than I did when I began Candyland.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that things can get a little bit too academic, and we can try to kind of like make things a bit rarefied and self-important. One aspect of progressive journalism, I don't mean progressive in a political sense, but just like as we kind of
move forward,
are trying to do the most honest work we can,
yeah,
is that we accept that we have that objectivity is basically non-existent. Everyone sees things from a subjective point of view.
Yeah.
So the point is not to in a kind of like reporterly, you know, I think obsolete fashion where you kind of deny your subjectivity and act like a robot and try to erase any hint of personal, you know,
yeah,
relationship to the things you're witnessing. It's much more honest to be transparent and forthcoming and accountable for your subjective position and offer that to your audience for them to come to their own conclusions. And constantly be asking yourself, you know, how is my subjectivity and positionality on this influencing the way that I'm reporting this? So, you know, I think that that's the practice. The practice is to constantly be asking yourself how you know what you know and why you feel and how the way you feel is influencing what you're saying.
And I know I said that was my last question, but I have one more, especially like in light of the fact that Doug Ford's new OSAP cuts would mean that student journalism on Ontario would lose its funding. So can you speak to why student journalism is important?
I mean, student journalism is really important to the journalism industry because that's where people start. Mm-hmm. And there are so many people who found their love for newspapers in working for a student newspaper, in working for a student radio station. It's sort of like the miners, and it plays right into the industry. And so it's a resource that the industry relies upon for sure. You know, when I was in school, like I probably would have been in a position of like, why should I have to pay for this thing? And you know, I always was like a little bit of a dick about this idea that, I don't know, like how seriously student journalists cover student government. And it was just like, what are
smooth.
You guys doing? Like, just, yeah. Have fun. Like, there's just so much, like, why do you think this is so important? And it's like, it always felt to me like Model UN. Like, everyone was sort of like playing like they were like in a real grown-up society. And I didn't understand it because I had other interests in university, but looking back on it now, the people who took that stuff seriously probably shaved 5 or 10 years off of their careers when they entered journalism, and I would have done a better job. I don't know, I'm blathering on. All of which is just to say, like, it's kind of bullshit to me what the Ford government is doing, and, you know, the very fact that they're listing athletics as an essential service.
Oh my God.
But not journalism, like, you know, that also brings back, you know, adolescent memories of just my interests being disparaged by the, you know, like that you know, we were allowed to skip class if we went to the football game. And
yeah.
I always felt like, what the fuck is that? Like,
yeah.
Can people skip class to come watch me draw comic books? Like, you know, why is your hobby legitimized by the administration and mine is not? So, you know, I can kind of find a way to be offended by either side of this. But, I don't know. I get the other side of students or the government saying like, hey, here's a way to reduce costs. But I think if you really look at like the practical, and I'm much more interested in how things actually play out than the ideology of them as I get older, the practical fallout of this is that it's just going to rob campuses of all sorts of good things, you know?
Yeah, diversity and, yeah.
Yeah. to have all these options available for extracurricular stuff, to have these career paths, to have campus life be, you know, and every now and then the student press reports something that, like, you know, the mainstream press and the professional press would have completely missed, that
exactly.
is of like national relevance, and yeah. then we steal it from you and don't credit you. That's
exactly
sort of how it always works, you know? So, you know, the value of it versus the, like, you know, couple of bucks that students are asked to put into it, you know, I think it's a valuable thing, and it's, you know, we're just seeing civil society decimated. I think that this is a petty, mean-spirited thing that really is also evidence of just Doug Ford's kind of war on words and thinking yeah. and civil society, yeah. you know.
So blatant, man.
Yeah, it's ugly. It's ugly.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us, for talking to me. I hope you have a great day.
Thanks. Thanks for your interest. Nice talking with you, too.
Nice talking to you. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in this week, and thanks to Desi Brown for talking to us. Please tune in next week for an interview with Cinema Politica Concordia and Venezuelan journalist Rafael Cabrizas. Playing us out, we have We Find Love by Daniel Caesar.
Heaven help us. find love, yeah, we get up. We fall down, we give up.
I could give you